Prodigal Summer, Disc 2.
Chapter 2, Moth Love. Lusa was alone, curled in an armchair and reading furtively, the only way a farmer's wife may read, it turns out, when the power of a fragrance stopped all her thoughts. In the 11th hour of the 9th day of May, for one single indelible instant that would change everything, she was lifted out of her life. She closed her eyes, turning her face to the open window and breathing deeply. Honeysuckle. Lusa shut the book on her index finger. Charles Darwin on moths, that was what she'd been lost in. A description of a virgin Saturnia carpini whose scent males flocked to till they covered her cage, with several dozen even crawling down Mr. Darwin's chimney to find her. Piles of Lusa's books on the floor were shoved halfway out of sight behind this old overstuffed chair, the only spot in the house she had claimed as her own. When she first moved in, she'd dragged this chair, a strange thing upholstered in antique green brocade, across the big bedroom to the tall south-facing window for the light. Now she leaned forward in her seat and moved her head a little to see out through the dusty screen. Far away at the opposite edge of the hayfield, her eye caught on Cole's white T-shirt and then made out the rest of him there, the forward-arching line of his body. He was leaning out from the tractor seat, breaking off a branch of honeysuckle that had climbed into the cedary fence row high enough to overhang the edge of the field. Maybe that plume of honeysuckle was just in his way, or maybe he was breaking it off to bring back to Lusa. She liked to have a fresh spray in a jar above the kitchen sink. Survival here would be possible if only she could fill the air with scent and dispatch the stern female ghosts in that kitchen with the sweetness of an unabashed blooming weed. Cole was nearly a quarter of a mile away across the bottom field, tilling the ground where they'd soon set tobacco. It seemed unbelievable that his disturbance of the branch could release a burst of scent that would reach her here at the house, but the breeze was gentle and coming from exactly the right direction. People in Appalachia insisted that the mountains breathed, and it was true. The steep hollow behind the farmhouse took up one long, slow inhalation every morning and let it back down through their open windows and across the fields throughout evening. Just one full, deep breath each day. When Lusa first visited Cole here, she'd listened to talk of mountains breathing with a tolerant smile. She had some respect for the poetry of country people's language, if not for the veracity of their perceptions. Mountains breathe, and a snake won't die till the sun goes down, even if you chop off its head. If a snapping turtle gets hold of you, he won't let go till it thunders. But when she married Cole and moved her life into this house, the inhalations of Zebulon Mountain touched her face all morning, and finally she understood. She learned to tell time with her skin. As morning turned to afternoon and the mountain's breath began to bear gently on the back of her neck, by early evening it was insistent as a lover's sigh, sweetened by the damp woods, cooling her nape and shoulders whenever she paused her work in the kitchen to lift her sweat-damp curls off her neck. She had come to think of Zebulon as another man in her life, larger and steadier than any other companion she had known. But now there was her husband across the field, breaking off the honeysuckle branch to bring back to her. She was sure of it, for he'd tucked it between his thigh and the padded seat of the Kubota. Its cloud of white flowers trembled as he bounced across the plowed field, steering the tractor with both hands. His work on the lower side was nearly done. When he returned to the house for his late morning coffee and dinner, as she was learning to call the midday meal, she would put the honeysuckle branch in water. Maybe they could talk then. Maybe she would put soup and bread on the table and eat her bitter words from earlier this morning. They argued nearly every day, but today had already been one of their worst. This morning at breakfast, she'd nearly made up her mind to leave. This morning, he had wanted her to. They had used all the worst words they knew. She closed her eyes now and inhaled. She could have just let him laugh, instead, at her fondness for this weedy vine that farmers hated to see in their fence rows. This week's gardening column in the paper was devoted to the elimination of honeysuckle. That had been the jumping-off point for their argument. "Be vigilant. The project will require repeated applications of a stout chemical defoliant," she had read aloud in her version of a stupid, exaggerated mountain burr that she knew would annoy Cole. But how could she help herself? It was the county extension agent who wrote this awful column called Gardening in Eden, whose main concern, week after week, was with murdering things. It stirred up her impatience with these people who seemed determined to exterminate every living thing in sight. Grubbing out wild roses, shooting blue jays out of cherry trees, knocking phoebe nests out of the porch eaves to keep the fledglings from messing on the stairs. These were the pastimes of Zebulon County, reliable as the rituals of spring cleaning. And he had said, "If you're making fun of Zebulon County, you're making fun of me, Lusa." "This I need to be told?" she'd snapped, as if, sitting in this kitchen where she felt the disapproving presence of his dead mother, she could forget where he'd grown up. Cole was the youngest of six children, with five sisters who'd traveled no farther than the bottom of the hollow, where Dad Widener had deeded each daughter an acre on which to build a house when she married, meanwhile saving back the remainder of the 60-acre farm for his only son, Cole. The family cemetery was up behind the orchard. The Wideners' destiny was to occupy this same plot of land for their lives and eternity, evidently. To them, the word town meant Egg Fork, a nearby hamlet of a few thousand souls, nine churches, and a Kroger's. Whereas Lusa was a dire outsider from the other side of the mountains, from Lexington, a place in the preposterous distance. And now she was marooned behind five sisters-in-law who flanked her gravel right-of-way to the mailbox. Silently then, after snapping at him, she'd watched Cole eat his breakfast for a while before slapping down the offending newspaper and getting up to face her work, stepping out the kitchen door to retrieve yesterday's milk from the cool back porch. She was still in her slippers and seersucker nightshirt at that point. They hadn't been out of bed for an hour yet, and the fog was still lifting above the creek. An Io moth rested on the screen, her second favorite moth, whose surprising underwings were the same pinkish gold as her hair. Her favorite would always be Actius Luna, ethereal green ghost of the upper forests. "Worn out from your big night of love," she scolded. "That's what you get." But of course he'd had no choice. All the giant silkworm family, the Ios and Lunas she admired, did their eating as caterpillars, and as adult moths, had no mouths. What mute, romantic extravagance, Lusa thought, a starving creature racing with death to scour the night for his mate. She picked up the milk and handled it carefully, noting that it was nicely set, ready to separate. There wasn't but a gallon. They kept only one milk cow for the homemade butter and cream Cole liked, and milked her only in the evenings now. Lusa had shocked everyone with her proposal of eliminating the inconvenient 4 a.m. milking by putting up the cow with her calf in the barn overnight. She could even pasture mother and calf together and skip milking altogether if she needed to drive to Lexington for a weekend. Did it take a scientist to think of this? On days when Lusa wanted to milk, they simply pushed the calf into a pasture separate from his mother so her udder would be full by evening. Cole's sisters disapproved of this easy arrangement, but Lusa felt smug. If they'd spent their girlhoods as slaves to the twice-daily milkings, that was not Lusa's problem. She had her own ways of doing a thing. She'd neatly mastered the domestic side of farming in less than a year, and Cole loved her cooking more than he'd loved his mother's. Now, as she stood at the sink, dipping the skimmer and watching the cream flow smoothly over the rim in a stream so thin it was nearly green, she had an inspiration. Fat bouquets of Savoy spinach stood ready for picking in her back door garden. Sautéed in butter with sliced mushrooms, a bay leaf, and this cream, they'd make for a fragrant, sensuous soup Cole would love. She could have it ready by noon when he came in for his dinner. She would concentrate on soup then and try to let this argument go by. But Cole wouldn't do it. "Why don't you write the garden column for the newspaper, Lusa?" he'd goaded her from the breakfast table. "Think of all you could teach us sorry-ass bumpkins." "Cole, I have to concentrate on what I'm doing here. Do we have to fight?" "No, dear, I'm just sorry," he said, not sorry at all, "that I'm not from some place fancy where people keep their dogs in the house and their gardens in window boxes."
"Will you ever let it go? Lexington's not fancy. People there just have more to read and write about than killing the honeysuckle in their hedgerows."
"They needn't to bother. They don't have hedgerows. Every city yard I ever saw ended in the flat killing mulch of a sidewalk."
In many species of moths, Darwin had observed, the males prefer to inhabit more open territory while the females cling under cover. She and Cole were a biological cliché, was that it? A male and female following their separate natures. She glanced up from her waterfall of cream, wondering how to gentle down this thing between them. "A city person is only part of who I am," she said quietly. The lines they drew in argument were always wrong. He put her in a camp she hadn't chosen. How could he understand that she'd spent her whole sunburnt, freckled childhood trapped on lawn but longing for pasture? Spent it catching butterflies and moths, looking them up in her color-keyed book and touching all the pictures, coveting those that hid in wilder places. He cracked his knuckles and locked his hands behind his head. "Lusa, honey, you can take the girl out of the city, but you can't take the city out of the girl." "Shit," she said aloud, giving in to pure irritation. Did he actually think he was clever? She'd mishandled the skimmer and dropped it too low, right at the end, giving up most of the cream she'd just skimmed. Now it would take another half day to separate again. She tossed the skimmer into the sink. "For this I spent 20 years of my life in school." She turned to face him. "I'm sorry my education didn't prepare me to live here where the two classes of animals are food and target practice."
"You forgot bait," he drawled.
"It's not funny, Cole. I'm so alone here. You have no idea." He picked up the paper and folded it back to the beef prices. So that would be that. Her loneliness was her own problem, and she knew it. The only people she ever talked to, besides Cole, were all in Lexington. When he suggested that she make friends here, she could picture only the doe-eyed, aggressively coiffed women she saw in Kroger's, and then she'd run to the phone to snipe about small-town life with Arlie and Hal, her former lab mates. But lately, their support had run out on Lusa, to the tune of embarrassing phone bills. "What's the problem exactly? You're not happy, so walk away. You've got feet. Get back here while you can still recover your grant money." She set herself to the task of sterilizing the milk utensils, trying to forget Arlie and Hal. Her former and present lives were so different that she couldn't even hold one in her mind as she lived the other. It embarrassed her to try. Instead, she soothed herself with an ancient litany. Actius Luna, Hyalophora Cecropia, Automeris Io, Luna, Cecropia, Io, the giant Saturniid moths, silken creatures that bore the names of gods into Zebulon's deep hollows and mountain slopes. Most people never knew what wings beat at their darkened windows while they slept. It was just one more thing she couldn't talk about. her education, which far outstripped her husband's. Cole's standard joke, "I loved education so much I repeated every grade I could." And Lusa had never, ever believed his self-deprecation. From the day they'd first met at the University of Kentucky, she'd recognized him as a scholar of his own kind. Cole was there for a workshop on integrated pest management. A group of farmers in this county had raised the tuition and sent him to Lexington, knowing Cole would ignore the claptrap and bring back to them anything worth knowing. Their confidence was justified. He had not been automatically impressed with Lusa's status as a postdoctoral assistant, but had pressed her with questions when he saw how well she knew the Galechid moths, denizens of a grain crop in storage. His eyes, the blue of a rainless summer sky, had begun to follow her in a way that either alarmed or flattered her, she couldn't say which. She'd showed him her lab and her father's larger one in the same building, where he studied the pheromones of codling moths, notorious pests of apple trees. The laboratory moths lived scrutinized lives in glass boxes where scientists learned to fool the males into mating with scent-baited traps so their virgin brides might vainly cover the world's apples with empty, harmless eggs. Later on, but not much, Lusa and Cole had slept together in her apartment on Euclid Street. Cole made love like a farmer, which is not to say he was coarse. On the contrary, he had a fine intelligence for the physical that drove him toward her earthy scents, seeking out, with his furred mouth, her soft, damp places, turning her like fresh earth toward the glory of new growth. Her body, which she'd always considered too short and hourglass curved to be taken seriously, became something new in the embrace of a man who judged breeding animals with his hands. He gave her to know what she'd never before understood. She was voluptuous. She told him about the scent cues animals use to find and identify their mates, pheromones. That delighted him. "So it's all about sex, all you people in that laboratory all the livelong day, and getting paid for it." "Guilty," she confessed. "I study moth love." He was interested in moth love. More interested still when she explained to him that even humans seem to rely on certain pheromonal cues, though most have little inclination to know the details. Cole would, she thought. Cole, the man who buried his face in every fold of her skin to inhale her scent. He could only love sex more if he had antennae the shape of feathers, like a moth, for combing the air around her, and elaborately branched coromata he could evert from his abdomen for the purpose of calling back to her with his own scent. He'd asked, "When you fall in love with somebody for no apparent reason you can think of, then is that what's going on, the pheromones?" "Maybe," she'd answered. "Probably." He'd rolled onto his back then and locked his fingers behind his head, providing her with an opportunity to study him from close range. He was astonishingly large. His shoulders, his hands, the plane of his broad, flat stomach and chest, all of him made her feel tiny and delicate. Here was a happy giant, naked in her bed. "Tell me this, then," he said. "How come a woman will do everything humanly possible to cover up what she really smells like?" "I have no idea." Lusa had wondered this before, of course. Even shaving armpits defeats the purpose. The whole point of pubic hair is to increase the surface area for scent molecules, and she told him so. "Damn, if this isn't another thing entirely, sleeping with a lady scientist," he'd declared, smiling at her with a face she'd already begun to think about missing. Damn if he wasn't another thing entirely. And soon he would be gone, the happy, earnest enormity of him. His closely trimmed beard that marked lines on his jaw and up the center of his chin to his wonderful mouth. His beard made her think of the nectar guides on the throats of flowers that show bees the path to the sweet place where nectar resides. Her Euclid apartment had seemed to suit him so well that he delayed his departure for 2 days after the seminar's end. They hardly left her bed, in fact, and she had to call her lab to claim sudden illness. She was on the verge of asking him, not out of guile but just for curiosity, whether he habitually slept with women he'd just met, when he proposed marriage. Lusa was speechless. For the next year, he courted her with an intensity that caused her to ovulate during his visits. She began taking real care lest a pregnancy too close to their wedding provide his relatives with the goods on Lusa they seemed to want. Her mother's language had an expression for people like Cole's sisters. Born with 10 fingers so they can count to 9. Cole had finished his breakfast now and glanced up at Lusa as he lit a cigarette. He seemed startled to find her staring at him. "What?" he asked. "I was just remembering how much we used to like each other." "Oh, I forgot to tell you. Herb will be up here later this morning to borrow the pressure sprayer. Don't be surprised to see him digging in the storeroom." She glared. This was typical Cole, to answer an appeal to his emotional core by appearing not to have one. "I don't want Herb in our storeroom," she replied flatly. "So, I guess I'll have to go down to the barn and dig it out myself." "What for? Herb knows what a pressure sprayer looks like. Hell, he's the one talked me into buying it, and now he uses it more than I do." "And on his way to finding it, he'll be handling my collecting funnels and insect nets, storing up tales for Mary Edna to whisper to Hanny Mavis by way of Lois and Emmeline. No, thank you." Cole leaned back in his chair, smiling. "The 3 most efficient means of communication. Telegraph, telephone, telewidener woman." "I used to think that was funny, before their favorite subject was me." "They don't mean any harm." "Do you really believe that?" She shook her head, turning her back on him. "They did mean her harm. They had from the beginning. Since she'd become mistress of their family home last June, they'd had little to say to her and everything to say about her. Before Lusa herself had ever set foot in the Croker's or the hardware store, she was already known as a Lexington girl who got down on all fours to name the insects in the parlor rather than squashing them. "My sisters have more to do than to sit around hating you," Cole insisted.
"Your sisters haven't learned my name yet."
"Lusa, come on."
"You ask them. I'll give you $10 if one of them gets it right, the whole thing, Lusa Maloof Landowski. They make a show of not being able to remember it. You think I'm kidding? Lois evidently told Oda Black my maiden name was Zucchini."
"Now, that can't be."
"Oda was clucking that she could see why I'd rushed you to the altar to be rid of that." She watched his face, trying to see if he even understood this humiliation. Lusa had kept her own name when they married, but it hadn't mattered. Everyone called her Mrs. Widener, as if there were no Lusa at all.
"Well, in spite of despising you with all her heart," he said patiently, "Lois invited us down for a big supper Memorial Day. She wants us all to go out to the cemetery in the afternoon to decorate Mommy's and Dad's graves."
Lusa cocked her head, curious. "When did she call?"
"Last night."
"The whole family's invited? How can Lois do that? Her kitchen's the size of a phone booth."
"It was much bigger before the ruffles and plastic ducks prevailed."
Lusa had to smile.
He gestured. "Here's the kitchen. Why don't you ever invite everybody up here?"
Lusa stared at him, slack-jawed.
"Well, what?"
She shook her head. "How can you possibly be so dumb? How can you sit there in the middle of this hurricane of hateful women and act like it's a nice sunny day out?"
"What?"
She marched to the corner cabinet in the dining room and returned with a particular china plate, which she held up like a flashcard.
"This means nothing to you?" "It's your wedding china."
Her wedding china, true. It had been her family's, a pattern from England with delicately tinted botanical paintings of flowers and their pollinators. But did they have to scorn everything she loved?
You don't recall what happened at the dinner I had here last July, a month after we married, the birthday party for you that I spent about 2 weeks cooking without help in my first failed attempt to impress your family?
No.
Let me help you out. Picture your eldest sister. Picture her sitting in that chair, blue hair and all, forgive me, wearing a face that would curdle milk. Picture me serving her dinner on this plate right here.
He laughed. I recall Mary Edna took a bite of potatoes and saw a black widow or something underneath and screamed.
It was the wing of a sphinx moth, a painting of a sphinx moth. I would not have china with black widows on it, and she didn't scream. She laid down her fork and crossed her hands like a corpse and has refused my invitations ever since. Even Thanksgiving, Cole, for God's sakes, in your family home where you and your sisters have eaten every Thanksgiving dinner of your lives prior to the mortal offense committed by your wife against Her Majesty Mary Edna.
Let the rest of them come without Mary Edna, then. She's always made too much of herself for being the oldest.
They won't come without Mary Edna.
He shrugged. Well, then, maybe they're just country folks that don't understand plates with bugs and fancy Latin words printed on them. Maybe they're just scared they'll use the wrong fork.
Damn you, Cole! Damn your whole family, if all you can do is ridicule me!
She grew hot in the face and felt like smashing the plate for effect, but the gesture would be all wrong. The plate seemed more valuable than the marriage.
Oh, Lord, he clucked. They warned me about marrying a redhead.
Shuchach, she muttered, sinking her teeth into the harsh Arabic consonants as she stomped into the dining room to put the plate away. Lusa was embarrassed by her tears, shamed that the spurned invitation still stung. Too many times in this past year she had hung up the phone and walked around in circles on the braided rug in the parlor, a grown married woman with a degree in entomology, sobbing like a child. How could she care so much what they thought of her? Any girl who pursued the study of insects had learned to ignore public opinion. But what she couldn't bear, then or now, was the implied belief that she was a curiosity, a nonsense of a woman. Lusa feared, in retrospect, that she judged her own father the same way, pitied him for being such a bitter, unworldly man, for devoting himself to agriculture in disinfected laboratories smelling of ether. Both her parents had come from farming lineages, but they had no more acquaintance with actual farm work than could be gleaned on a Sunday drive through the racehorse pastures east of Fayette County. Lusa had wanted to be different. She'd craved to shock people with her love of crawling things and her sweat. She could still feel the childhood desire in her body, a girl bending close to breathe on the mirror when hard play on summer days dampened her strawberry hair into dark brown tendrils against her face. As a woman, she'd jumped at an unexpected chance to be a farmer's partner. She'd never expected the strange, effete legacy that followed her here to Zebulon, where her new relatives considered her old ones to be a family of fools who kept insect pests alive in glass boxes on purpose. She returned to the kitchen without looking at him. If he could act like this wasn't tearing him apart, she could do the same.
"Check," she said. "Do not serve anything to a widener on bug plates. I'll remember that. And check, open the door to Herb, the great and glorious varmint killer, when he comes to rifle through my storeroom for the pressure sprayer."
Herb and Mary Edna were a perfect marriage in Lucy's opinion. The one was exactly as superior and tactless as the other.
"What in the world does that mean?" Cole asked.
"Do you know what Hanny Mavis told me yesterday? She said one time Herb found a den of coyotes up in the woods above his fence line, a mother and a litter of nursing babies. She said he put a bullet in every one of their heads, right in their den."
Cole gave her a blank look. "Is that true?" she demanded. "Did you know about it?"
"Why bring up the subject?"
"When was it? Recently?"
No, it was way last spring, I think. Around the time your mother got sick. Before the wedding, anyway. That's why you didn't know about it.
Oh, back that long ago. So it doesn't matter now.
He sighed. Lusa, they were meat-eating animals setting up camp on a dairy farm. What do you think Herb's gonna do? Give his profits away to the wolves?
Not wolves, coyotes.
Same thing.
Not the same thing. Did it occur to anybody to be interested in the idea of coyotes being here, 2,000 miles or something from the Grand Canyon?
I expect he was interested in what they eat, such as a newborn calf.
If that's even what they were, coyotes, which I doubt, knowing Herb's eyesight. I also doubt if he shot them, to tell you the truth. I bet he missed. I hope he missed.
Herb Goins with a rifle is a frightening proposition. I will not argue with that. But if you care to know my end of it, Lusa, I hope he got them.
You and everybody else in the county. I know. If Herb didn't get them, then somebody else will.
She wished she were dressed. She felt vulnerable and unconvincing in her nightshirt. She went back out to the porch, letting the screen door slam behind her. She set the milk back into the cooler to re-separate and noticed that the Io moth was still hanging on the porch screen. She reached up and gently slapped the screen where it clung.
Better fly on out of here, she said. No insect is safe around here.
She watched the moth flare open, showing its watermelon-colored underwings with their startling pair of black pupils. An owl's eyes, she thought, a perfect likeness. Pity the little bird that opens its mouth for a bite of moth and gets stared in the face by that. Jolly old life, full of surprises. She returned to the kitchen with a jar of last summer's tomatoes in each hand. Instead of the soup, she would make imam bayildi, her mother's stuffed vegetable recipe, which Lusa herself much preferred to anything milky. Cole wasn't crazy about imam bayildi. He was even skeptical of spaghetti, which he called an Italian dish. But it was his fault she'd lost the cream, so fine then, let him eat foreign food. I've stooped to this, she thought. The former National Science Foundation scholar with the most coveted postgraduate fellowship in her department now wields her influence on the world through acts of vengeful cooking. His whole big, exasperating person was still there at the table, smoking cigarettes. Arcs of pale ash stretched like starry nebulae across the dark tabletop between his left hand and the ugly tin ashtray balanced halfway off the table. The whole scene looked like something she'd like to wad up and throw away. It wasn't like Cole to be this slow getting out to his cattle and his tractor. It was a full hour past dawn now. The sun was well up. Was he that determined to vex her? What does Herb want with our pressure sprayer anyway? She asked. I don't know. No, I do know. He said they're exterminating at the church. They got some kind of bees moved into the walls, Mary Edna said.
Oh, that's perfect. Exterminating God's creatures down at the church. It's a good thing God didn't leave Herb and Mary Edna in charge of Noah's Ark. They'd fumigate it first, and then they'd sink it.
He refused to laugh. Lusa, honey, where you come from, maybe they think it'd be nice to have a church full of bees. People get sentimental in a place where nature's already been dead for 50 years, so they can all get to mourning it like some relative they never knew. But out here, he's alive and kicking and still on his bender.
My husband, the poet. Nature is an uncle with a drinking problem.
He shook his head. That's how it is. You have to persuade it 2 steps back every day, or it will move in and take you over. Cole could fend off her condescension with astonishing ease. He had his own I-can-put-up-with-this tone of voice that made Lusa want to scream her red head off.
Take over what? She said, trembling to hold back a rage. You're nature. I'm nature. We shit, we piss, we have babies, we make messes. The world will not end if you let the honeysuckle have the side of your barn.
We have babies? I didn't notice, his look seemed to say. But he asked her instead, why tolerate a weed when you can nip it in the bud?
Every word they said to each other was wrong. Every truth underneath it unsayable, unfindable. Their kindnesses had grown stale, and their jokes were all old chestnuts, too worn out for use. Lusa threw down the dish towel, feeling suffocated in clichés.
You have a nice day out there in the big woolly jungle. I'm going to do your laundry. Your damn cigarettes are stinking up the kitchen.
While you're cursing tobacco, you might consider it was last year's crop that bought your new washer and dryer.
Yilhan Dinuch, she shouted from the hallway. If my Arab mama had taught me to swear, I wouldn't be proud of it, he called back.
Arab mama, Polak daddy, he held this against her too, apparently, along with the rest of his family. But hadn't she ridiculed his accent, his background? And yet neither of them truly was that kind of person. Layers of contempt crouched, camouflaged beneath one another until it was too much to sort out. If she and Cole were married 100 years, they'd still be fighting without knowing why. She felt sick and defeated, stomping from room to room to collect cast-off shirts or socks they'd shed in the downstairs rooms. Some were hers. There was nothing to say, but still they said it. The honeysuckle and the tobacco. In less than a year of marriage, they'd already learned to move from one argument to the next. Just like the creek that ran down the mountain into this hollow, flowing out of its banks into the ruts of their driveway, then back again into its creek bed at the bottom of the valley. Arguments could fill a marriage like water, running through everything, always, with no taste or color but lots of noise. Bitter Creek, that stream was named, and the hollow running up the back of their farm into the National Forest, people called Bitter Hollow. Perfect. I am too young to feel this way, she thought, trudging upstairs to collect the rest of the laundry while he headed out to till the bottom field. How would it be in 10 years? Had she really wanted so badly all her life to live on a farm? A bird in the hand loses its mystery in no time flat. Now she felt like a frontier mail-order bride, hardly past her wedding, and already wondering how she could have left her city and beloved career for the narrow place a rural county holds open for a farmer's wife. It was only 4 hours later, in the 11th hour of the 9th of May, as the dryer clicked and droned downstairs and she sat beside her bedroom window reading, that Lusa's life turned over on this one simple thing, a potent rise of scent, as her young husband reached out his muscled arm for a branch of flowers. Here was what she'd forgotten about, the full, straight truth of their attachment. Her heart emptied of words for once and filled with a new species of feeling. Even if he never reached the house, if his trip across the field was disastrously interrupted by the kind of tractor accident that felled farmers in this steep county, she would still have had a burst of fragrance reaching across a distance to explain Cole's position in the simplest terms conceivable. Lusa sat still and marveled. This is how moths speak to each other. They tell their love across the fields by scent. There is no mouth. The wrong words are impossible. Either a mate is there or he's not, and if so, the pair will find each other in the dark. For several more minutes, her hands lay motionless on her book while she considered a language that could carry nothing but love and simple truth. 10 days later, the marriage would reach its end. When it came, Lusa would look back to that moment at the window and feel the chill of its prescience. No one would have called it a premonition exactly. Cole's tractor did not overturn. And it wasn't tobacco that killed him, or at least not smoking. She could have allowed him the pleasure of 2 packs a day. It would have made no difference in the long run, since there was to be no long run. Tobacco's failure was partly to blame, though. The drop in price supports that had pressed him to take part-time work driving grain deliveries for southern states.
Lucan knew this outside job shamed him as a farmer, even though there was hardly a family in the whole valley that got by solely on farm profits. For Cole, the failure was not simply one of money, but one of attachment. He hated being away from the farm for even one night when he had to make a run over the Blue Ridge and down into North Carolina. She had told him they could find the money elsewhere, maybe by borrowing against next year's cattle, though he mistrusted debt, and the new tractor had already put them in deep. Or she could teach at the community college in Franklin. Would that also shame him? She wasn't sure. She was thinking of that, picturing herself with a class of nursing students in a biology lab just before the sheriff drove up to inform the next of kin. It was very early, a damp dawn that had committed itself to nothing yet, still perfectly windless and scentless. May 19th, still a nothing of a day, though the date would never again pass unnoticed after this. She was standing at the same upstairs window, watching fog drift up the edges of the fields, uphill along the hedgerows, like the ghost of some ancient river whose tributaries no longer heeded gravity. There was a strange quality to these mornings when Cole was away, and she woke up here alone. She was free. As free and disembodied as a ghost. She focused her eyes out in the middle distance of the yard, where she could see the frenzied movement of nocturnal insects in the shadows, noctuid moths looping crazily through the last minutes of this night's search for a mate. When she saw Tim Boyer's sedan with its seal on the side, she understood. If he were just hurt, in a hospital, that was something Tim could have stopped down below to tell. He could have given the news to Lois or Mary Edna first. This was a different mission, requiring notice to the wife. She knew why. Did not know the details, would never know some of them, in fact. The damage to the body was of the kind that sisters and brothers-in-law discuss at length but wives are never told about. But she knew enough. Now, she thought, her body going cold, as the long white car moved so slowly up the driveway that she could hear the individual pops as the gravel shifted beneath the tires. Right now, from here on, everything changes. But that would not be true. Her decision and all the rest of her days would turn not on the moment when she understood that Cole was dead, but on an earlier time at that same window when she'd received his wordless message by scent across a field. Chapter 3. Old Chestnuts. 8 years a widower, Garnet still sometimes awoke disoriented and lost to the day. It was because of the large empty bed, he felt. A woman was an anchor. Lacking a wife, he had turned to his God for solace. But sometimes a man also needed the view out his window. Garnet sat up slowly and bent toward the light, seeing as much with his memory as with his eyes. There was the gray fog of dawn in this wet hollow, lifted with imperious slowness, like the skirt of an old woman stepping over a puddle. There were the barn and slat-sided grain house, built by his father and grandfather in another time. The grass-covered root cellar still bulged from the hillside, the two windows in its fieldstone face, staring out of the hill like eyes in the head of a man. Every morning of his life, Garnet had saluted that old man in the hillside, with the ivy beard crawling out of his chin and the forelock of fescue hanging over his brow. As a boy, Garnet had never dreamed of being an old man himself. Still looking at these sights and needing them as badly as a boy needs the smooth lucky chestnut in his pocket, the talisman he rubs all day just to make sure it's still there. The birds were starting up their morning chorus. They were in full form now, this far into the spring. What was it now, the 19th of May? Full form and feather. He listened. The Prothalamion, he had named this in his mind years ago, a song raised up to connubial union. There were meadowlarks and chats, field sparrows, indigo buntings, all with their heads raised to the dawn and their hearts pressed into clear liquid song for their mates. Garnet held his face in his hands for just a moment. As a boy, he had never dreamed of an age when there was no song left, but still some heart. Chapter 4, Predators. She sat cross-legged on the floor of the porch, brushing out her hair and listening to the opening chorus of this day. A black and white warbler had started it long before dawn, breaking into her sleep with his high-pitched, sweet, sweet. Deanna could picture him out there, circling the trunk of a poplar, tilting his tiny little zebra-striped head toward the first hints of light, tearing yesterday off the calendar and opening the summer of love with his outsized voice. She'd rushed out to the porch in her nightgown and bare feet, the hairbrush mostly an afterthought lying on her lap. She needed to listen to this. Prodigal summer, the season of extravagant procreation. It could wear out everything in its path with its passionate excesses, but nothing alive with wings or a heart or a seed curled into itself in the ground could resist welcoming it back when it came. The other warblers woke up soon after the black and white. First, she heard the syncopated phrase of the hooded warbler with its upbeat ending like a good joke. Then the Kentucky with his more solemn, rolling trill. By now, a faint gray light was seeping up the edge of the sky, or what she could see of the sky through the black-armed trees. This hollow was a mean divide, with mountains rising steeply on both sides and the trees towering higher still. The cabin was no place to be if you craved long days and sunlight, but there was no better dawn chorus anywhere on earth. In the high season of courtship and mating, this music was like the earth itself opening its mouth to sing. Its crescendo crept forward slowly as the daylight roused one bird and then another. The black-capped and Carolina chickadees came next, first cousins who whistled their notes on separate pitches, close together, distinguishable to any chickadee, but to very few humans, especially among this choir of other voices. Deanna smiled to hear the first veery, whose song sounded like a thumb run down the tines of a comb. It had been the first bird call to capture her fascination in childhood. Not the calls of the meadowlarks and sparrows that sang outside her windows on the farm every morning, but the song of the veery, a high-elevation migrant that she encountered only up here on fishing expeditions with her dad. Maybe she'd just never really listened before those trips, which yielded few trout and less conversation, but so much silent waiting in the woods. "Now, that's a comb bird," her dad had improvised, smiling, when she asked. And she dutifully pictured the bird as a comb-shaped creature, bright pink. She was disappointed years later when she discovered its brown, ordinary birdness in the Peterson Field Guide. The dawn chorus was a whistling roar by now, the sound of a thousand males calling out love to a thousand silent females ready to choose and make the world new. It was nothing but heady cacophony unless you paid attention to the individual entries. A rose-breasted grosbeak with his sweet, complicated little sonnet, a vireo with his repetitious bursts of eighth notes and triplets. And then came the wood thrush with his tone poem of a birdsong. The wood thrush defined these woods for Deanna, providing background music for her thoughts and naming her place in the forest. The dawn chorus would subside in another hour, but the wood thrush would persist for a long time into the morning, then pick up again in early evening or even at midday if it was cloudy. Nanny had asked her once, in a letter, how she could live up here alone with all the quiet, and that was Deanna's answer. When human conversation stopped, the world was anything but quiet. She lived with wood thrushes for company. Deanna smiled a little to think of Nanny down there in the valley. Nanny lived for neighborly chat, staking out her independent old lady life, but still snatching conversation wherever possible, the way a dieter will keep after the cookies tucked in a cupboard. No wonder she worried for Deanna. The sky had a solid white cast by now, mottled like an old porcelain plate, and the voices began to back off or drop out one by one. Soon she'd be left with only the thrush song and the rest of her day. A few titmice and chickadees were congregating at the spot underneath a choke cherry a dozen yards from her cabin, where she always scattered bird seed on top of a flat boulder. She'd chosen a spot she could watch from her window and had put out seed there all winter. Ordered birdseed by the 50-pound bag, in fact, along with her monthly grocery requisition. The Forest Service never questioned it. It wasn't exactly policy to feed chickadees and cardinals, but apparently the government was willing to do whatever it took to keep a wildlife monitor sane through the winter. And in Deanna's case, it was birdseed. Sitting at the table beside the window with her coffee on snowy February mornings, she could lose hours watching the colorful crowd that gathered outside, envying the birds their freedom in the intense cold. Envying even their self-important fuss and bustle. A bird never doubts its place at the center of the universe. Now that it was the third week of May, buds were emerging and leaf-eating insects of every kind would soon be hanging thick on the trees, and these little Napoleons could find plenty to eat elsewhere, but they'd probably gotten addicted to her handouts. She was addicted to their presence, too. Lately, she'd been thinking about dusting off her Smokey the Bear hat. She'd been issued both Park Service and Forest Service uniforms as a glitch of this hybrid job, and putting it out there on the boulder every morning with seed on the brim so the birds would get used to landing on it. Eventually, she'd be able to put it on and walk around with a gaggle of chickadees on her head for no purpose other than her own foolish amusement. She'd finished brushing out her hair. It cascaded down her back and shoulders and folded onto the porch floor where she sat, rippling all around her like a dark, tea-colored waterfall glittering with silver reflections. More silver each year and less tea. She'd told her husband, X already by then, when he asked her why, that she was moving up onto the mountain so she wouldn't have to cut her hair. Apparently, it was a rule for women in their 40s, the short, perky haircut. He probably hadn't understood the joke, thinking it was some embryonic vanity on Deanna's part, but it wasn't. She rarely noticed her hair except to let it out of its braid for a run once a week or so, like a neglected hound. She just hadn't liked the rule, hadn't wanted to look her age, or any age. And who could be bothered with haircuts, weekly or monthly or whatever they had to be? Deanna actually didn't know. She'd managed to live her life apart from this and most other mysteries owned by women. Eyeliner, for instance. What was the instrument of its application? Did it hurt? And what on earth was the point? She'd never quite had a real haircut. Her dad had known better than to take a girl child to his barber, and if he'd meant to think of some other option, he didn't get around to it before her wild mane grew down to the backs of her knees. The most she'd done in the way of coiffure was to untangle it from tree branches and trim the ends with the scissors on her Swiss Army knife. That was the only kind of woman she had ever known how to be, in Zebulon County and later on as a schoolteacher and attempted wife in Knoxville. Up here in the woods, finally, she could be the only kind of woman there was. The kind without a man. Eddie Bondo was gone, and that had to be for the best. He'd said he'd be back, but she did not believe it. He'd taken everything with him when he went. Everything being his pack, which admittedly wasn't much. If what he said was true, that he intended only to hike over to Clinch Peak for a day or two and then come back to see her again, he would need his pack. So she couldn't judge his leaving by what he'd taken or left. It wasn't that. He'd called her hair a miracle. He'd said it was like rolling himself up in a silkworm's cocoon. She turned her face to the sky and listened to the blessed woods. That was what he'd left behind. A chance to listen to the dawn chorus and brush her hair without being watched. Eddie Bondo had left her this hard, fine gem of her very own, this diamond solitaire of a life. She stretched her legs straight in front of her while she rebraided her hair into its familiar rope, an exercise her hands could do without mirror or attention. When she'd snapped the rubber band back onto it from her wrist, she bent her forehead to her knees, giving her hamstrings a good painful stretch. Then she lay straight back, flat on her back like a girl, mouth and eyes open wide to the tree branches overhead. She gasped, dizzy, falling up, straight up into the treetops. Thought about the first time he'd laid her down on this porch. She wondered how she would look to him now, lying here like this. She cursed aloud and sat up. Damned thing, self-consciousness, like a pitiful stray dog tagging you down the road, so hard to shake off, so easy to get back. No man had ever spoken to her so freely of her body, or compared it to such strange and natural things. Not only a silkworm, also ivory, for instance, which he claimed was unnaturally smooth. He'd lived in Canada last summer into fall, he said, had gone up there to make money on the salmon run, and stayed on hunting caribou around the Hudson Bay, and somewhere in the process had learned to work walrus ivory into knife handles. She listened to his stories, imagining the possibility of touching nature's other faces. She'd known no other but this one. She asked him what birds there were. And he seemed to know, but couldn't name any except the game birds people shot for food. She had been listening too hard, she realized now, for the things he left out, what he meant or believed. To have her bare stomach compared to walrus ivory, was this strange compliment hers alone? She had no idea how to take him, but had taken him nearly as hard as possible. It still ran a shock of physical weakness all the way through her to think of certain things, his body against hers, the scent of his skin, the look of awestruck joy on his face when he entered her. She jumped up, shuddered from the cold and nonsense, and went inside to get dressed and find her day. She walked a circle around the room, stepping into jeans and boots without slowing down much. While she buttoned her shirt with one hand, she banged open the cupboard with the other and reached into the Dutch oven to grab some of yesterday's cornbread. She took a bite and stuffed the rest into her jacket pocket to eat on the trail, or later on, while she waited in the blind she was going to build. She'd wasted too much of this morning already. She'd stayed away from the den for such a long time, the first 2 weeks on purpose and the last 10 days of necessity. She hadn't dared to go. Even if she'd gone out alone or lied, he could have followed her. She took the Bitter Creek trail down the mountain as fast as she could without breaking into a run, which would be pointless. If they were there, they would still be there in 10 minutes. Or they might not be there at all. They were wary creatures, almost beyond a human's conception of wariness. And the day she'd discovered them, they surely had seen her first. It wasn't reasonable to think she could have outwitted or outsensed them. They could only assume she was an enemy, like every other human whose stink they'd ever caught wind of. If this was the same family that had lost half its members in one day over in the Zebulon Valley, the survivors would be cautious. She was sure it was that family, or else some other refugees of human damage. Why else would they have ventured so high up the mountain into this forest, so far from the fence rows and field margins that are a coyote's usual domain? When they came over here to whelp their pups, they'd have dug themselves multiple dens. Backup plans were their trademark, the famous coyote wiles. Everything that was possible to know about them, though, Deanna knew. That only the alpha female would bear young, for instance. The other adults in the pack would forego reproduction. They'd support the alpha instead, gathering food, guarding the den, playing with the pups, training them to forage and hunt after they emerged with their eyes open. If their parents got killed, the pups would hardly suffer for their absence. That was the nature of a coyote family. That was the point of it. And if Deanna's discovery of this burrow had disturbed the pack, its members would have moved those pups already to another place in the middle of the night. Any predator that needs to sleep at night has already lost the game with a coyote. She slowed to a walk and then stopped a quarter mile from where she recalled the den as being to consider building her blind. She'd have to be near enough to see, but downwind, of course, and the wind direction would change between morning and afternoon. She could build only one blind, since she wanted to create as little disturbance as possible and leave few clues in case anyone else should be poking around here. Mornings, then, it would be. She'd build the blind uphill and come to it only in the mornings, when the sun had warmed the fields down below and the air was still rising up the hollows toward the mountaintop. She'd forgotten how far down the mountain she'd come that first time to find this den by accident. Now, as she searched it out, she couldn't even be sure whether she was still on national forest land or on the farm below that bordered it. There wasn't a fence here. But it was in deep woods and higher than you'd expect. There wasn't enough known about coyotes in Appalachia to say what was really normal. They surely couldn't like the mountaintops. They'd prefer lowland fields because of field mice, among other things. But this family had its own history. It had been shoved to the wall, so it had come up high to stage its raids from safe hiding, like Geronimo. She began to move forward again slowly, breaking and collecting low branches from sourwood trees. She left the path, protecting her eyes as she pushed her way through a thick clump of rhododendrons. Her intention was to circle wide around the den to where she could look at it from across the creek. The rhododendrons were almost impossibly dense, but that was fine. No one would find her trail. She wondered briefly about whoever farmed the land below here and whether he liked to hunt. Probably he wouldn't come here. Most local farmers never set foot in the woods except in deer season, and then only with their friend Jack Daniels for company. The real trouble, the bear poachers and that ilk, generally came from other places. Those men specialized and so had to range widely. She sidestepped slowly downhill until she could see across the creek to the tangle of roots at the base of the giant fallen tree. She raised her binoculars to the slice of darkness beneath the roots, held her breath, and focused. Nothing. She sat down on a damp mattress of last autumn's leaves and prepared to wait. No point building a blind until she knew they were still here. Deanna knew exactly when the morning ended. She never wore a watch, and for this she didn't need one. She knew when the air grew still enough that she could hear caterpillars overhead, newly hatched, eating through thousands of leaves on their way to becoming Io and Luna moths. In the next hour, the breeze would shift. No sense taking a chance. It was time to leave, and she'd still see nothing. No movement, no sign. No little dogs, fox-like and wolf-like and cousin to both, so familiar from her studies that they sometimes ran through her dreams. Awake, she'd had good long looks at only one single animal, a pathetic captive that she'd rather forget, in the Tinker's Mountain Zoo outside of Knoxville. She'd pleaded with the curator to change the exhibit, explaining that coyotes were social and that displaying a single animal was therefore not just cruel, but also inaccurate. She had offered him her services, a graduate student in wildlife biology, finishing up a thesis on the Coyote Range extension in the 20th century. The curator had politely suggested that if she wanted to see coyotes in groups, she should take a trip out west, where the animals were so common that people got acquainted with them as roadkill. The conversation had given her a stomachache. So she'd written a grant proposal instead, invented this job, and put herself in it as soon as she had completed and defended her thesis. She'd had to fight some skeptics, wrangling a rare agreement between the Park Service, the Forest Service, and the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, so that there were almost more words on her paycheck than dollars. But it was working out fine, they all seemed to think now. 2 years after her arrival, one of the most heavily poached ranges of southern Appalachia was becoming an intact ecosystem again. All of that was the point, but to her mind, only partly so. She breathed out now, resigned. One day, she'd lay eyes on wily Canis latrans in the wild, right here in her own home range, on an animal path cross-stitched by other trails to the paths she'd walked in her childhood. It would happen, but it wouldn't be this day. On her way back up the mountain, she consciously slowed her step. She heard another magnolia warbler, a sign and a wonder, it seemed to her, like something risen from the dead. So many others never would rise again. Bachman's warbler, passenger pigeon, Carolina parakeet, Flint's stonefly, Apamia moth, so many extinct creatures moved through the leaves just outside her peripheral vision, for Deanna knew enough to realize that she lived among ghosts. She deferred to the extinct as she would to the spirits of deceased relatives, paying her quiet respects in the places where they might once have been. Little red wolves stood as silent shadows at the edges of clearings, while the Carolina parakeets would have chattered loudly, moving along the riverbanks in huge flocks of dazzling green and orange. The early human settlers, migrating into this region, had loved them and promptly killed them. Now most people would call you crazy if you told them that something as exotic as a parrot had once been at home in these homely southern counties. She stopped and stared at her feet. Here were tracks, fresh, and she paused to study them out, front and hind foot alternating single file in a long sinuous line, the front foot a little bigger than the hind. This was a canid, all right. The claw marks were there too, clear as could be. Where the tracks crossed a broad patch of clear mud, she knelt down to take a close look, measuring a cleanly outlined print with the knuckle of her index finger. 2¾ inches, front to back. "You learn what he is by knowing what he isn't," her dad used to say. This was not a gray fox and not a red fox. Coyote. A big one, probably male. Alpha's mate. A little farther on, where the trail crossed a clearing and most likely other animal trails, she found his scat. One single turd with an upcurled point on its end, like one of Ali Baba's shoes. This was coyote for certain, and who but a big male would make such a show out of his excrement? She squatted down and poked it apart with a twig. A coyote could eat nearly anything. Mice, voles, grasshoppers, frogs, human garbage, a house cat. The farmers down below were right to believe a coyote could take a lamb. Working together, a pack might even bring down a full-grown cow. But that would take a huge pack, 2 dozen animals maybe, more adult coyotes than existed in this county and probably this end of the state. And why on earth would they go to the trouble when there was so much else on the slopes of this mountain for a coyote to eat with greater safety and ease? Hardly a creature on earth could thrive more capably on junk that was useless to humans. During her thesis research, she'd found the notes of a biologist named Murray, who'd spent the early decades of his century dissecting coyote scat and recording its splendidly varied contents. He'd cataloged hundreds of different items in his journal. Her favorites were shreds of woolen clothing and watermelon poached. From the crumbling consistency of this scat, Deanna expected pine nuts and berry seeds, a predictable diet for the locale. She was surprised by the hard, dark glint of an apple seed. Then several more. Apple seeds at this time of year, late May? Apples were just barely past the blossom drop stage down in the valley. Wild apples still hanging onto the trees down there in the wilding fields would be a long shot. More likely, this fellow had crept into an orchard where someone grew old-fashioned leather coats that stayed on the tree all the way through winter into spring. Or he might have nipped into someone's root cellar and rolled the last sweet Arkansas blacks out of a bushel basket. Deanna was sympathetic. She'd stolen apples, too, in her time. Her dad's tobacco farm had been short on pleasures from a child's point of view, but when the two of them discovered Nanny Raleigh and her orchard, respectively, Deanna found seventh heaven. Nanny was a generous woman who did not count her Arkansas blacks after the guests left. Deanna's legs ached, but she squatted a little longer, taking the time to flatten and dissect the scat completely with her twig. Something else here surprised her. Millet seed, both red and white. No millet grew on this mountainside or on any farm down below, as far as she knew. Certainly not red and white millet together. That was a combination unlikely to be found on any farm. Mostly, it showed up in the commercial seed mixes people put out for their birds. Probably this was the bird seed she had put out herself. She stood up, blinking, peered downhill through the tree trunks, and thought about it. Who else around here was likely to be feeding chickadees? "You rascal," she said aloud, laughing. "You magnificent son of a bitch. You've been spying on me."
This ends Disc 2.